Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society for Ethical Culture. My name is Patricia Dubrovner. I'm an assistant leader of the society, and I'm the chair of its Adult Education Committee. Tonight, the New York Society for Ethical Culture, Demos, and New York Magazine join the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism's Felker Magazine Program in presenting this event in honor of Clay Felker, the founder of New York Magazine. While most of you know something about our distinguished panel, some of you may be wondering what ethical culture is all about. The New York Society for Ethical Culture was founded 130 years ago. We're a community of people who believe that we develop and define our character through the quality of our relationships with others. We are inspired by the ideal that the supreme aim of human life is to work to create a more just and humane society. The New York Society for Ethical Culture founded the first school in this city for working men's children, which later became the Ethical Culture Fieldston Schools. It established the district nursing service, which grew into the visiting nurse service, and we joined with others to establish the NAACP, the ACLU, and the Legal Aid Society. Membership in ethical culture is open to all who share our values, and I invite you all to get to know us better, to visit our table out in the lobby and get more information, and you can check us out on the web at nysec.org. Tonight, we explore the ethics of journalism. And I'm sure you wouldn't all be here tonight if you didn't feel, as we do, that a free press is one of the most valuable possessions of our democracy. Now it is my pleasure to introduce to you Miles Rappaport, president of Demos, a network of ideas and action.
Thank you very much. And on behalf of Demos, we are delighted to be co-sponsoring tonight's event. My name is Miles Rappaport, and I think what we're going to hear tonight is not only an interesting discussion, but an extremely important one and an extremely important moment. Just to say a word about Demos, we are a policy, research, and action center based here in New York, a kind of think and action tank, if you will, dedicated to presenting in the public debate three fundamental principles: expanding democratic participation, fighting for economic fairness, and restoring a proper role for the public sector after 30 years of bashing by the conservative forces in our society. Several reasons that we're excited to be at this particular forum. One, it corresponds very closely with our interest in expanding democratic participation. It is not possible, it seems to me, to have an expansive, vibrant, participatory democracy without a press that is doing its job and serving its ethical purposes. Secondly, we've got an awesome panel of speakers, people who we have known and admired for our lifetime, all people with something very serious to say. And lastly, it seems to me that tonight's panel couldn't be more timely. We've been in a situation in which many of us have been concerned, disturbed, whatever the adjective is, even dumbfounded at the fact that the policies and the direction that our country has been taking over the last 4, 6, 8 years are so troubling to us as people caring about economic justice and democracy. If you travel, and many of you do, the first question that you are often asked as an American is, how is it that you have let things come to this pass? Fortunately, we have a panel tonight that will help us to answer that question. One of the key issues is, how is it that the press has functioned during this period? How is it that it has fulfilled its role? And how might we change it and encourage it to fulfill it more? I'm not going to introduce the panel. I'm going to leave that to Dean Schell. But let me just introduce Dean Orville Schell. He is the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Many of you probably know of his voluminous and thoughtful writings about China. He's the author of 14 books. 9 of them were about China. He's written for the New York Review of Books, New Yorkers, Harper's, the New York Times, The Atlantic, and any other magazine you want to name. He has also served as a correspondent and a consultant for several PBS Frontline documentaries, as well as an Emmy Award-winning program on China for 60 Minutes. We're delighted to have as our moderator tonight, Dean Orville Schell of the University of California at Berkeley. Dean?
Well, thank you all for coming. And before we get to our panel, I wanted to say a few words about why we wanted to do this event in Clay Felker's honor. As some of you may know, the magazine program at Berkeley is the Felker Magazine Program. And you may be familiar with his pedigree as a young lion in New York in the magazine world, really catalyzing such things as New Journalism, The Village Voice, Esquire, New York Magazine. We have Adam Moss here tonight, the current editor. A wonderful magazine, just won a General Excellence Award from the National Magazine Association. And I don't want to labor Clay's public persona, but I just want to tell you that when I came to Berkeley as dean, Clay had just started. And it so happened that he began to be dogged by illness. But I've never seen anybody fight so tenaciously and so with such determination to keep teaching, to produce magazines, to edit, to mentor students. And some of the students are here tonight, and they did bond very deeply with Clay. So Clay's in the back. I just want to say it's great to see you here tonight, and it's been wonderful working with you these last 10 years. So join me in giving Clay a hand. Now, before we begin, we've asked Clay's wife, the very distinguished writer, Gail Sheehy, if she would read just a few short words that that Clay has written. So, Gail, please come up.
Well, it's my honor, not my habit, to speak for Clay Felker. He usually speaks very well for himself. The UC Berkeley Journalism School, he wrote, has been my intellectual and spiritual home for over a decade. And he says, when Tom Goldstein, the former dean, asked me to create a center for the study of magazine journalism at the school, my new parochial New York colleagues at first thought they'd never see me again. They sent me off to Berkeley saying, we'll stop by to see you the next time we're in L.A. But in fact, the cross-pollination between the what Clay says is the best journalism school in the country and the hottest media environment here in New York has been very fertile. My deepest satisfaction, he writes, has come from helping students blossom and then following their career development as they move out into the world. And it's the very graduates of the Felker Magazine program whose talent has earned them enviable positions in New York journalism who've taken it upon themselves to continue to stimulate support for the program. And 4 of them thought up this evening's event. Lauren Barrick, who wrote for the St. Petersburg Times and the New York Post until she graduated into a successful freelancer between taking care of her 4-year-old child. Rachel Lehmanhaupt, who writes for New York and the New York Times Magazine. Spencer Ante, a valued editor at Business Week, and Bill Brazel, who is working with the founder of the magazine industry standard, John Battelle, for an online publishing company that supports bloggers. In my view, Clay says, the secret of magazines is passion for the subject matter. And the Berkeley Magazine program gives students a hands-on opportunity to create publications from scratch about their passion. For instance, Rachel Lehman Haupt and Lauren Barrick's third wave feminist humor magazine, which they called F. You can just make up your own definition. Valley Girls, which was about women professionals in Silicon Valley. Frontera was about second-generation Mexican-Americans and their distinctive culture. And Quake City, which looked at the Bay Area as part of the country that's beautiful but also threatened by nature. Clay says, as I move on to write a book about the golden years of magazine journalism, I'm delighted that the Felker Magazine program will be headed up by Deirdre English, a veteran editor of Mother Jones and a fellow believer in the power of literary journalism to explain and enlighten. Deirdre, would you stand up? Thank you. Lastly, Clay says, I remember being recruited to be on the development staff of a magazine which later became Sports Illustrated. At a luncheon meeting with Henry Luce, the famous editor asked us all, what is the purpose of a sports magazine? We all gave inadequate answers. Later that day, we got a memo from Luce, the famous editor, which wound up quoting scripture, be not afraid to teach. In other words, we had to strive for more than just reporting who won and who lost. Well, Orville Schell has never been afraid to teach. He is dedicated to cultivating journalists who are broadly educated in history, economics, cross-cultural awareness, binding them into a community of shared values, and that is more precious than ever now that journalism is under such severe attack. Clay finally says, it's been one of the greatest gifts of my life to serve as an instructor under Orville's leadership and to extend my life experience as an editor by learning how to teach. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Gail. All right, the topic at hand, ethics in the media. I think we all know too well that there are many imputations lofted, and there's a growing tendency to presume that somehow the press is failing on the ethical front. So I think our effort tonight is to try to parse through just where that comes from. What causes it? How does it feel to our panelists to work in a climate where they're increasingly under attack themselves from various quarters? And finally, I think the question we have to ask ourselves is there a remedy? I think everybody in this room and everyone on this panel would agree that the press does play an incredibly important watchdog role. It was very clearly delineated as such by the founding fathers. And yet I do think we are on the precipice of risking some of the teeth of that watchdog. So what I want to ask the panel, and we're just going to go down the line here, and I'm going to ask you all to be rather diligent about limiting yourself to 7 minutes so we can have discussion. What was this craft like when you came into it? And we'll start with Helen because she goes back farthest. And then tell us a little bit about how things have changed. Now, so let me quickly tell you who we have here. I think you probably know most of these esteemed people. Helen Thomas, First Lady of the Press. She's covered the White House since JFK. Helen clearly has her fans. She wrote for UPI and now works for her syndicate. And as all of you, I'm sure, know, the president very often takes umbrage at those moments when Helen does succeed in rising from the back bench to ask a question. Then we have next in line here, Randall Pinkston, who's a longtime CBS News correspondent since 1994. He's covered almost every conflict with which the United States has been involved, from Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Haiti, won several Emmys, an Edward R. Murrow Award for an outstanding documentary production. Richard Stengel became the managing editor of Time magazine just this year. He has covered many presidential campaigns. He's written for numerous magazines such as The New Yorker and obviously Time, The New Republic, The New York Times Magazine, and has a particular interest in the ways in which the craft of journalism dovetails into the workings of democracy. Then we have... We have Adam Moss, who is has been the editor of New York Times Magazine and also is the sort of impresario of various cultural sections of the newspaper, and then moved to New York Magazine, which Clay Felker had a great deal to do with. And as I mentioned earlier, the magazine recently won a National Magazine Award for General Excellence, and it's really turned into quite an enterprise. And finally, we have Jeff Jarvis. Jeff was a TV critic for TV Guide and for People magazine. He started Entertainment Weekly. He has one of the more, I think, unalloyed, honest, straightforward, sometimes cutting blogs called Buzzsaw on the media, and he's now running the new media operation at the new CUNY Journalism School, which is just starting its first year. So, welcome all. So, Helen, our question, when you came into this back in the Kennedy presidency, what was the state of ethical grace at that point? And if you look at the evolution since, what do you see?
Well, I think that you always look back with longing and have a feeling about the good old days. And maybe they were not that great, but I think the state of journalism has been lousy. I really do think that in the run-up to the war with Iraq, I think reporters let the country down and rolled over and played dead. And part of it was because of 9/11 and this whole feeling that you had to be patriotic, and if you asked challenging questions, you were un-American and so forth. So then it segued into the war where you were jeopardizing the troops, they thought, and so forth. But I used to get calls when I was covering LBJ and Nixon and so forth. Who in the hell are you? Who elected you? But why are you asking such mean questions? After the war with Iraq, everybody said, where is the press? I mean, the press really wasn't there when they should have been. March 6, 2003, President Bush gave a press conference. It was very clear. He was telling the world, telling the country, we were going to war. And there was no question asked of him why. I'm very honored to be here, but I don't consider myself an expert in the ethics of journalism. I do know that it is a profession that has prided itself on its standards and the search for truth, which is the Holy Grail. I do believe that the 20th century was the golden age of journalism, the greatest generation of journalists, and we have lost something in the translation with the proliferation of new, ungoverned forms of communications. Everyone with a laptop thinks they're a journalist today. Accuracy is sometimes in the eyes of the beholder, and the bloggers have often stepped up to the plate to tell us we were wrong. Our missteps certainly seem greater and seem to be more widespread than in the past. Perhaps it's because our mistakes are so easily spotted on the internet and everything else. Fabrication of stories, bogus sources, gullible editors, government manipulation of news at home and abroad, paying broadcasters here and planting pro-American stories in the Iraqi press, a disbanded disinformation office when it was revealed at the Pentagon, reporters playing ball in wartime, forgetting that their one weapon in the run-up to the war or in any other situation is skepticism. Their lack of outrage at the administration's deliberate deceptions, no weapons of mass destruction, no ties to the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda, and no threat. Fixing the facts around the policy. Truth took a holiday in this administration. The unchallenged secrecy has allowed for spin and distortion. The reporters need to be seen, need to be seen as patriotic after 9/11, as I said, and all contributed to the weakening of the power of the press. Despite all, journalists are performing and dying in the cause of freedom of the press. More than 80 in Iraq, including reporters, photographers, interpreters, assistants in the war so far. For all that, there is no question that the media is doing the best it can to keep the people informed. And without that, there can be no democracy. And I do think it's very sad that we have become a country of one newspaper towns, and that Wall Street seems to be controlling what the newspapers, their output, who they hire, and so forth. It was never like that. I didn't know that I would long for the good old days of family newspaper where, of course, families wanted to make money, but they made their money in real estate, mining, whatever, and they had a great integrity about serving the community. Now it's the bottom line, the bean counters, the profiteers. I think that we've lost a lot, and I think it's easy to come back and restore the ethics of this profession.
Thank you, Helen. Randall, let me ask you, why did you get into this trade? And sitting as you do in broadcast, which is often considered to have been one of the most eroded forms of media, what's your experience been like over the last, say, 10 years in terms of the direction in which you feel our profession has gone and its ability to do credible and excellent ethical journalism?
Well, personally speaking, I'd like to think that we still do credible and ethical journalism from the ground. I view ethics as something that my parents taught me about good manners. It begins at home. It begins internally. I want to share with you, first, let me just ask a question. How many of you are students of journalism or hope to enter the field in the next few years? Raise hands, please. Okay, so some of what I'm going to speak about tonight is addressed directly to you because, in a real sense, while my dear colleague Helen Thomas has a vast number of years of experience, and along with my other colleagues, you're the people on a day-to-day basis who are going to be filling the time slots for local TV stations, for your community papers as you begin your careers. I became a journalist almost accidentally. It was a part-time job, and I was working at a radio station in my hometown, Jackson, Mississippi. WJDX, AM, and FM. The sister station, WOBT, is very important in communications law, and it's another story, but if you're interested, go to LexisNexis, look up United Church of Christ versus FCC, the WOBT license case. It had something to do with why I was hired, but as I said, another story. Anyway, so I'm producing a little show called Viewpoint, and it was real simple, thankfully, because I was beginning. It was my first job. The field reporters for the radio station would bring a collection of interviews on tape. Tape, not digital. Remember tape, folks? Long time ago. And I had to splice these interviews down into 60-second packages, three or four of them, which would run the following day. And the format was something like, what do you think about potholes in Jackson? And then you'd have a series of people answering, and then you'd have a little tag out. Well, one day a reporter brought his tape to me, and I don't remember the question, but I do remember thinking as I listened to the responses that there was something funny about it. The voices sort of sounded the same. And I figured out that he had pretended to be the people he was supposed to interview. Now, It's 9 p.m. at night. I've got some homework I've got to do. It was a part-time job. I was in college at the time at Millsaps College, and I had to, you know, work on my history paper. I majored in history. There were no standards and practices people to call. There was no guidebook, and I didn't even know at that time about the Associated Press guidebook on standards, but it would have helped because I had to get these four things done. So what to do? Well, the first thing I decided was that I was not going to put something on the air that wasn't true. So I discarded his tape. I went to the phone book. I turned on the old-fashioned tape recorder, the one with the big reels. You may have seen them in pictures and in movies. Hit play and record, and I began to just randomly call people. I would, like, open the phone book, did the Steve Hartman act, one of my colleagues at CBS, you know, like, okay, I'll dial this number. And I got about 8 or 9 responses, and I used those interviews as the content for that next day's Viewpoint. And I asked him later, never mind his name, why did you do that? And he said, I was in a hurry and I didn't have time to go down to town to ask people, so I just had to give you something. Now, here is a hypothetical. If that happened to you, what would you do? Would you report it? Or would you just let it pass? I'll tell you what I did. I didn't use the material, but I didn't tell the boss either. And on that point, I probably failed. But on the fundamental point, what our viewers were what our listeners were going to hear, I think I did okay on my very first test case. And really what I'm getting to is this point, that it's not brain surgery. It's truth. As Helen said, the search for truth is the Holy Grail. There are many ways to search for truth. There's more than one side of the story. It always amazes me when people say, get both sides of the story. Stories have many sides. You try to tell as many sides as you can, but at least search for those sides. And then beyond that, you sometimes have to lobby really hard with your bosses to get the stories on that you think are important and to do them the way that you think they should be done. You're going to hear from managing editors in a moment, and they probably have a different take on that, but from the field, we get frustrated a lot. I can't say that we are more frustrated now than we were in the past. I recall a CBS News president named Fred Friendly, who had a lot of experience and skill in deciding what news was, helped to build the CBS News network. At one point, he wanted to broadcast some hearings, the opening hearings in the U.S. Senate, on why should we be in Vietnam, the Vietnam War. And there were some people in programming who thought that, I think it was I Love Lucy, should remain on the air. And that decision, along with some other things that had happened earlier, prompted Fred Friendly to resign from his job as the president of CBS News. These days, network news presidents don't have to make that choice because the last time I checked, there have been no congressional hearings on the war in Iraq, at least not yet. Is that an editorial comment? Anyway, but the point I'm getting to is that you have to have leaders at the top who are willing to do battle with the powers that be, and you have to have people on the ground who are reporting. And at some point, you have to salute. If when my boss says, no, we're not going to do that story, it does me no good to become angry and, you know, slam the door. You look for something else. You look for another opportunity. Keep this in mind, too, when you're dealing with ethics, that truly journalism is the first draft of history. I majored in history, so I like to think that to the extent that we can bring context and perspective to our stories, we should do that. One of our failings, group failings, is the tendency to allow some public officials to make statements that most of us know the statements aren't true, or maybe there's some question about it, but they just make the statement and there's nothing else said. If you're out there in the audience and you're listening to this and you're hearing it and you keep hearing the same thing repeated all the time, at some point you might believe it. Whereas if we were to question them, to press them, well, are you sure? Well, prove that. Well, didn't a certain commission say that wasn't the case? Getting close editorial again, right, Helen?
No.
But in any event, you get the point. That reporting the fact...
Fired already.
That reporting the fact of what an official says without also challenging them when you know there's some question about their assertion, that may not be the best kind of ethical journalism. Finally, let me just speak for a moment about external factors. Dean Schell mentioned to me my take on ratings and competition and fracturing of the market. Well, obviously, that's way beyond my pay grade. That's what my bosses deal with. But it's nothing new. It's nothing new. There have always been these frictions between the marketplace and what we try to do in our holy sepulcher of journalism. At my company, at most networks, there is a line, there's a wall that separates those of us who do the work of journalism from those who have to pay our salaries. And that's a very good thing. So I can truly sit here and say that never have I ever felt any pressure one way or the other in terms of the stories that I've been assigned because of sales factors. Now, you look at a broadcast that's going down in the ratings and you're working on that broadcast and you think what you're doing is worthy, but someone who has to pay the bill says, well, you know what? If we keep going in this direction, we won't have an audience and you won't have a job anyway, so let's change directions, let's change the format. Is that being unethical? I don't think so. I think it's just a function of journalism is a business. And sometimes business decisions are made that we don't agree with as journalists, but if those decisions are arrived at ethically, what can we say? We can either continue to do the work there, or we can move to another location. So those are some of my thoughts, sir, on the way I see the state of play today and how I've arrived at my place.
Thank you. Now, I want to admonish the remaining panelists to try to be mindful of 7 minutes or we won't have much time for questions. Rick, let me ask you, if in fact there is a contradiction between the marketplace and journalism in its sort of ideal form, how have you experienced that in your lifetime? And now you are, in effect, the boss. How does that contradiction come home to roost in your office?
Thank you, Orville. I'm delighted to be here. And I just want to say Clay Felker is one of the true giants in our profession, so I'm glad that we're honoring him and glad to be here. Orville called me and he said, Rick, do you believe in free speech? So I said, of course I believe in free speech. I'm the editor of Time magazine. And he said, well, I'd like you to give one. So so that's why I'm here. Your question, I kind of quarrel with the premise of it about, because I believe that quality and good journalism and a successful business are not at odds. They're not mutually exclusive. I'm a great believer in democracy with a small d, and that I think Americans can suss out the difference between journalism that's tawdry versus journalism that's strong and powerful. And I think the marketplace reflects that. That's the system that we live in. Before we came on, when Orville said to us, I want you to go back and talk about what ethics were like when you started, and Helen said, you mean in the time of George Washington? But I do want to take us back for a second to the time of George Washington, because our business, our profession, is the only one that is constitutionally protected. The framers thought that what journalists needed to do was so essential to the preservation of freedom and a free republic that it had to be protected by the First Amendment. And the reason they protected it is because they were afraid of government forcing its way into people's lives, and they were afraid of something that we don't hear about very much anymore, the tyranny of the majority against the minorities. And a free press was a way, part of the checks and balances system, to fight that possibility, to fight that possibility of tyranny and to fight the possibility of totalitarianism. At the time, Jefferson wrote a letter at the time of the writing of the Constitution saying, given the choice between a republic without newspapers and newspapers without a republic, I'd choose the latter. Now, he always exaggerated, but the idea is that a free press was necessary to the lifeblood of a democracy, because people in a democracy need to be informed about things. If you have a democracy where people don't have knowledge about what they're voting on, you don't really have a democracy, and that leads you towards totalitarianism, which, in fact, a lot of the framers thought we would tend toward anyway. You know, Jefferson also said, you know, a democracy can never be ignorant and free. That's our job, is to make sure that people are not ignorant. They need to know what they are voting on. But to pick up on this idea that both Helen and Randall mentioned, and that it will probably be a little bit unpopular, and that's the notion of the pursuit of truth. At the risk of sounding like a, you know, freshman in philosophy, I don't really think there is such a thing as the truth. What we pursue is facts, what we pursue is ideas, and the notion that there is, in fact, one truth out there about anything, to me, is a dangerous one. To go back to the notion that the framers created, we reach truth by having people on opposite sides quarreling with them. That's the way our legal system works. That's the way our constitutional system works, with checks and balances. It's not one person who's a repository of the truth. That is totalitarianism. What we need to do is to fight it out in the marketplace of ideas. That is where a true reckoning of the state of things occurs, and that's something that we all do every day. We're fighting it out in the marketplace of ideas, whether it's in magazines, whether it's in TV, whether it's in the wire services, whether it's online. And this issue now is an issue that is something that we spend too much of our time having to think about and reckon about. I mean, you know, inside, before, you know, the conversation among Jeff and Adam and myself is particularly, well, what is the future of print? You know, what is the relationship between online and print? And, you know, Helen mentioned the fact that there's this now, this era of people blogging, and anybody with a computer is a journalist. You know, I say bring it on. I mean, that does go back to the early days of the Republic. I mean, Thomas Paine was the first blogger. People in the 18th century, if you could pay for somebody to print a bill or a story you'd written or a brief or a petition, you did it and you distributed it. That's a little bit like what the situation is now. I think that is democracy with a small d in terms of journalism, and I welcome it. Well, the thing is, the people out there are the people who judge the standards. I mean, I'm an editor.
You decide yourself, because that's your ethical approach.
But I mean, if raise your hands. I mean, how many people went on read a blog in the last 2 days? Raise your hand. I mean, you know, part of what the situation that we're trending toward is the fact that one of the trends nationally and even internationally is the sort of death of the gatekeepers. People don't trust people in authority. They don't trust journalists who are editors, they don't trust established institutions. I mean, if you just go on Amazon.com and people read reviews by other folks of books and not by professional reviewers, we have to reckon with that. In some sense, and this is something that Jeff has talked about, in some sense, the journalists of the future are actually moderators. And you're saying, here's an interesting opinion over here, here's a view over here, here's a view over there. You know, you need to reconcile them. That's the job of a consumer of media, a consumer of journalism, now and in the future, I think. And that's something that we all have to figure out. Even, you know, as august an institution as Time Magazine, that's been around for 83 years, you know, we have to reckon with that. It cannot be us sitting on stage telling people what to think or what's right or what's the truth. That day is over.
Discussion segment.
The facts are not the truth always, so.
He asked for it.
Take notes, Helen. We'll come back. Thank you, Rick. Adam, let me ask you, are we a well-informed, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say a well enough informed society to actually function in the way that Rick is suggesting, i.e. democratically?
Well, I think that we, you can hear me, right? We are certainly an informed society. There's a lot of information coming at us. For the most part, I think that Rick is right. And I think Rick sort of has to be right, because that's the world we're in right now. And I think it's our obligation as citizens to be better informed, be more critical, and and ultimately to assign ourselves a more active and less passive role as an audience of media. But let me go back to the sort of question that is the topic here today, which is specifically about ethics and journalism, and like Randall, tell a story, though I don't come out anywhere near as well as he does in his, because it gets right to the heart of the matter. In the spring of 2001, when I was at the Times Magazine, I signed a young writer, and I'll tell you his name because he wrote a book about this himself. His name is Michael Finkel, to do a story on child slavery in Africa. Mike was one of the star writers of the magazine. He was as fearless a reporter as I'd ever seen, as ambitious a reporter, and a very powerful storyteller. First story he did for the magazine was in it he snuck aboard a boat of would-be immigrants from Haiti who were lured by hustlers trying to smuggle them to America. The boat was rickety. Chances were very good that the boat wouldn't make it, and indeed the boat started to sink in the middle of the passage with Mike on it. They all got off the boat. Mike wrote a wonderful story, won a Livingston Award. We sent him to Afghanistan. We sent him to Israel. His record was perfect. This assignment was his idea. He'd heard that that a bunch of NGOs in Africa were claiming that there was child slavery. He thought that was interesting, particularly these were on cocoa plantations. He wanted to go down and investigate. He did go down. He filed a draft during the summer. And he came to a provocative conclusion that this was not slavery at all, but in fact something that these kids willfully engaged in order to survive, and that the NGOs were holding them to a kind of paternalistic standard. So he filed the draft, which was provocative, but it was a narrative muddle. And so his editor asked him to try to tell the story differently, and to tell the story through the storyline of one individual. And Mike said he would try to do that. 3 weeks later, he filed another draft, and it was riveting, meticulous in its detail, and written almost like a series of jazz riffs in its prose style. We loved it, we accepted it, and we planned to run it. September 11th happened, and we held the story, and then in November of that year, we were ready to run the story, which we, you know, it's the kind of story as an editor you dream of, because it was so vivid and true to the kind of literary journalism that I came into this business to do. Largely because of Clay Felker's success and efforts as an editor. We ran the story, fine. Several months later, the story was called, as Yusuf Male, that was the boy's name, a slave. As we were about to close the story, we discovered we had no picture. The photographer we had sent down there had no picture of the boy. But Mike himself supplied a picture, said, I have one. It was a very good picture. We ran the picture. 3 months later, we got a phone call from, I think it was Save the Children, and to tell us that they were very disturbed by the article because it contradicted, it was in effect an attack on them, and it contradicted one of their main causes. But they wanted to go down and find it themselves. They went down there. And they found the kid in the picture, and that kid was not Yusuf Male. We called Mike up. I was very concerned about this. We hadn't fact-checked the story. We hadn't fact-checked the story because the story took place in a place with no email, no fax, no phone. He was our star writer. We had nothing but positive experience with him. And we had a practice at that time of not reviewing notes or listening to tapes. We asked him to provide the notes. He said he would. He took a little while with it. By about 72 hours later, my calls to him were very urgent. And he said he would fly into New York. He lived in Berkeley, as it turned out. And he said he would fly into New York immediately and deliver the notes in person, and he felt awful about this. Somewhere mid-flight, he got a pang of conscience, and by the time he landed, he decided to confess that, in fact, when the editor had asked him to tell the story through a single person, he didn't have enough. So he conflated several characters and fabricated a story. The story that he felt was truthful in its essence, but was, in fact, a lie in all of its particulars. It was a horrifying experience for me. This was a year before Jason Blair, and the Times ran a lengthy editor's note. I tell this story because it's about the worst thing that could possibly happen to an editor about ethics, and yet, to the larger question of this panel, which is, do I think that this is a more horrible time for ethics and journalism? I don't. And I don't for a lot of reasons. One key reason is because events like this happen more often in a way that we know about them. Helen said that she thinks that the internet might be in some ways responsible for that, and I think that's true. These events are much more public, but I don't think that they're more numerous. And I think that the fact that we talk about it so much is healthy for us. I think it makes all editors hyper aware of these kinds of transgressions, and I think it makes writers more frightened. I also think it's healthy for, you asked about the audience at the beginning, or the readers, I think it's healthy for readers to know that journalism is a human and flawed enterprise. I think that's good for democracy. I think the web in general at these times, during these times, is good for truth, however you want to define it. It's complicated, but I, you know, think ultimately it's a positive superego. It has a positive superego function. This is not to say, however, that I think we're in particularly good times for journalism. But that's something else. I think that we're timid and we're nowhere near aggressive enough. And I worry about that a lot more than I worry about ethics. And not being aggressive enough has certain ethical implications, for sure. I do worry about other things. You know, I worry about readers. You asked me that at the beginning. Readers can be given a set of facts. Readers can be told that Iraq and Al-Qaeda had nothing to do with one another, and they could be told again and again and again, and still they could believe otherwise. In part, they could believe otherwise because the government has gotten extremely good at preventing journalists from doing their jobs, and journalists have been, to a large extent, stymied by them. But I think government gets away with it in part because of courts, and courts are far less understanding, I think, of the press freedoms that Rick talked about. And I think that in part, courts are responding to what I think they feel is an American mood which doesn't value press freedoms the way it might have 5, 10, 15 years ago. And that's the thing that scares me the most, much more than ethics.
Thank you, Adam. Jeff, in many ways, I think it's fitting that you were last, because you were the one who's been most involved in online efforts and your blog, Buzz Machine. Let me pose this question. Do you think all of the blogging and the online revolution has helped or harmed the state of credibility and ethics of the press?
I think it helps. Being in this hall makes me mindful of mid-80s, when I had been a Cub reporter and then a columnist in San Francisco, Chicago, and came here to be TV critic at People magazine. An honorable profession, I'll argue. And at the end of one season, I was on a CBS morning show talking about the ratings for the season. And in fact, the shows at the top of the ratings were very good, you know, Cosby Show and Hill Street Blues and so on. The producer came to me and said, Jarvis, you're defending the taste of the American people. And I recoiled in horror. I'm a media snob. How can I do that? This is TV of all things. But as I thought about it, I thought, she's right. If we give people the choice of watching good things, they watch good things. TV of all things proved the taste of the American people. And it made me into a populist that, to me, is a continuous string from the remote control and the VCR and the cable box giving us control of the consumption of media to the internet that gives us control of the creation of media. And that we, the people, now have a rightful and proper role in media. So what is that role? I think when blogs began, in the words of Ken Lane, an early blogger, he said famously, we can fact-check your ass, which is a great thing. If we care about the truth, if we care about the facts, then we care about that. I absolutely agree with Rick that it's not our, even apart from there being a truth, is it our job to own the truth, to know the truth? No. It's our job to help the people decide what they believe is true. And I get my first person plurals mixed up here in terms of big media man and blog boy. But I think that what we see now is a new opportunity for a collaboration in journalism that was never possible before. I believe we're going back to a time before the day when TV networks killed those competitive newspapers in towns and got us to one newspaper towns and got us to the point where we had many voices, all the way back to the pamphleteers. We're back to that day now when we have many voices. And we're not used to this cacophony. We're used to hearing one voice in a standard way, an institutional voice. But that was not the natural state of media. The natural state of media is that we all have a voice. We all have a viewpoint. We find new ways to express that and new ways to join in together. And the internet allows us, there are projects like Jay Rosen's newassignment.net that are collaborative journalism projects where we can all join in and report together, or where the people can fact check our asses, and that's good for journalism. And I think that there is a different ethic that then comes to play. I've been enraging editorialists in my blog lately, arguing that the institutional voice is an outmoded voice. It's one that we really don't believe in this new world. We believe in the voice of human beings. Read the Clue Train Manifesto, and it says that we recognize the authentic voice of people. And so the unsigned voice of an editorialist isn't terribly believable. The ethic that I was raised in journalism school was one of objectivity, which I now think was a false god that we couldn't meet. I think the ethic that I see now that I've learned online in my third journalism school, of the sense of having become a blogger, is that transparency is our ethic. And that to have an eye-to-eye conversation with people is what this is about. And that we are just fellow citizens trying to do this together and trying to figure out the ways to do this. So I think that we are global, we are local, we can reach across the world in wholly new ways now. And I'm frustrated in the news business, particularly the newspaper business, that we try to fret about saving the old, saving the newspaper, saving the newsroom, when in fact there are whole new and wonderful opportunities here to explode and expand journalism in ways that we could not have imagined or accomplished before. And so I think it's our goal and our duty to figure out how to take part of that. So we have to redefine what a news organization should be. We have to redefine its relationship to the public. We have to change this view of respect to the public and realize that, yes, if you give people good TV shows, they'll watch them. They just will not watch the Beverly Hillbillies, only because we've made them do it. That if you give people the facts, they will make wise decisions. And if you don't believe in that, then I argue you don't believe in democracy or in journalism or in free markets or in reform religion or in education or in art. That you have to have an essential faith in the people, and that's what this hall actually stands for. And then once you do that, your role becomes different. This does go back to Bernd Kundrin from Gruner & Jahr. So the role of journalists is to be more moderators today. And I expand that. I think the journalist can be a moderator of viewpoints and views and also of facts. And journalists can also be an enabler. We can bring the tools to enable people to gather and share news and facts in ways that were not possible before. We also become an educator. I'll get bloggers mad if I say that, you know, I don't need your stinking education. But bloggers do want to know how to file FOIAs and how to avoid libel laws and how to get the facts, and I think that we can help do that. So I think we need to see the role of journalism as central in society in a whole new way. I used to call this citizen journalism in one haughty phrase, and then journalists would get mad at me and say, well, I'm a citizen too. And so my response is, fine, then act like one, act like a member of the community. I also think it was wrong because it was wrong of me to separate the task of journalism by who performed it. Everyone and anyone can perform an act of journalism. We've seen it in disasters so far, in the tsunami and Katrina and so on, but it's not just disasters. It's everyday things. I emailed my school superintendent yesterday asking how safe our children are in five ways, and other bloggers started doing the same thing. Those are acts of journalism that anyone can perform, and we now have the ability, I think, to refigure that. We are at the 10th anniversary, I believe, if I'm right of this. We know of Fox News. I think they're having a party tonight. We weren't invited. And I read this somewhere of Al Jazeera and also The Daily Show. And I think that's an important moment for a new kind of journalism that isn't institutional, that whether you like it or hate it, and there's examples of that, that it has a human voice. We have to bring the humanity back to journalism. And when you have the humanity back, you don't rely on cold tablets of rules. You rely on a relationship of human trust. And that's where ethics come back. When I was at Time Inc., doing Entertainment Weekly, there were some uncomfortable moments then as we merged with Warner Brothers. And the editors did grade point averages of our reviews at EW. But it came down to the end of no rule from the Society of Magazine Editors and no rule from anybody else. It was the integrity of individual people to make journalism matter. It's the integrity of our relationship with human beings that makes journalism matter. And I think we have to get back to that. And the forget blogging. Blogging is only part of this. Blogging, podcasting, all this wonderful new technology is really an enablement of people to connect with each other and facts that matter to them.
Yes. I want to just turn this over to the panel for some rebuttals here, but before I do that, for those of you who have questions, please pass them forward. Now, it may also be that you were moved to make a contribution to what the Society of Ethical Culture does, and if you are, please do that. These kinds of things go on more often if they have supporters like you. All right. Let me, in order to elicit some comments from you all, should newspapers be saved? Should reporters actually constitute a profession? Jeff has raised some pretty provocative points for the rest of you in the weary old media. How do you respond to that?
So the question is, should newspapers be saved? You know, I moved back to New York to take this job. I was in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia was one of the Knight Ridder papers that was for sale, and it was bought by a local owner. I think the future of newspapers is local and to be relentlessly local, and they have to focus on that. There are a few national newspapers like USA Today. New York Times aspires to be one, but isn't really one yet. But that people need to, you know, newspapers need to focus relentlessly on the local. But the one of the points that I want to make coming after Jeff, and it again goes to this idea that anyone can commit an act of journalism. When I first started covering politics, the first presidential campaign I covered was 1988. And I was on the road for, I don't know, you know, 3 months. And I had a suitcase of clothes, and then I had a suitcase of the following: the candidates' position papers, their speeches, you know, their briefings on various subjects. And I'm sure all three of us have had this experience before. You were out on the campaign trail and people would come to see a speech and they'd go, well, where did you get that? Where did you get that text of that speech? Or where did you get the position paper on the environment? And it was then the exclusive province of people in our profession, which I don't really think it is. And that regular citizens, regular voters, didn't have it. What is available now to everybody in this audience and everybody in the world is more information that was available to this exclusive tribe that we were a member of going back 15, 20 years. Everybody, every citizen has access to so much information today that I think it empowers people. I mean, fact-checking. Everybody becomes a fact checker when you have access to the same information that all of us have. The question is, do you read what we do because we can take that same set of ingredients and make something fantastic out of it, right? You know, we can take, like, that restaurant where you choose the ingredients and then you choose the way it's prepared. I mean, You know, you can do that yourself, or you can say, I'm going to actually go to a restaurant where all the food is cooked. But the choice is yours. And I think this is an era, as Jeff was saying, of a flowering of a new kind of small-d democratic journalism. And I think whether newspapers survive, whether any of us survive, is how we reckon with all of that.
Helen, did you have something you wanted to say earlier and got repressed? Please speak now. Did you have something you wanted to say?
It didn't. No.
No. All right. That's.
I do.
Randall.
Concerning faith in the people and the access that all of us have to the marketplace of ideas, I referenced briefly how I got into this business many years ago. It had to do with a lawsuit that was filed against a TV station for discriminatory broadcasting. There was a time in parts of America when if certain people would come on the air, the screen would go dark. And a little slide would come up saying, temporary transmission difficulty. It would happen with people like Thurgood Marshall and Sammy Davis Jr. and Nat King Cole. Didn't happen with Perry Como and, you know, those folks. These are old, old names, and some of you are my age, so you know what I'm talking about. In a word, this particular station was guilty of discriminatory broadcasting. The station, however, was held to account because it was using free electric magnetic spectrum to transmit its signal. And we haven't even dealt with this question, this issue, because we're talking really about different forms of communication here. Where I work is still governed by the government, the Federal Communications Commission. Newspapers never have been, I don't think. Probably if they were, it was in times of war. The web, of course, is totally free, but there's this thing called net neutrality that threatens to make a differentiation between the kind of access that we can all have on the web versus the kind of access that big players, may I say, like your organization or where I work now would have on the web. Then, do we have faith in the people to have equal access across the spectrum? And if we don't, what do we do? And I raise a question. I'm just a worker here, you know, in the trenches. But it is something that if you're going to buy into this idea that we no longer are two or three big entities and we don't have to worry about diversity of opinion, how do we assure that the person with the small microphone can have access to the marketplace of ideas like the one with the big one? How do we do that? Is that something that should be considered? Is that an ethical consideration? A question, a few questions.
I'll take that, I guess. I think that's built into the system. I think that what happens is that now that owning content or owning distribution is no longer king, the relationship is king. What happens is that because you can get television soon through your ITV Steve Jobs box, going from the internet to your TV, from the internet to your TiVo, right to my laptop, and because there are, Desperate Housewives is on iTunes right next to Rocket Boom, the vlog, there is a new level playing field that never existed before, or almost level, a lot leveler than existed before. And so what happens is we have the opportunity to make content, we have the opportunity to distribute content, we have the opportunity via the link to market content, and it is discovered on its merit. I think that we are definitely past the age of mass media where we're all treated as one size fits all, and those new voices are coming out. I think it's a mistake, though, to measure the new media in the terms of the old media and that only big matters. This is a mass of niches. It's a mass of communities of people who care about what they care about. And yes, there'll always be big TV shows and Oscars and football games, and that's fine. But now the definition of big enough has changed so that my son, my 14-year-old son and webmaster, JakeJarvis.com, makes more from Google ads than he gets from his cheap dad's allowance. It's big enough for him. Rocket Boom, the vlog, now sells $40,000 ads in a week. It's big enough for them. It's a different economy of communication that has opened it up to more people. So I'm very optimistic about a new opening of the world of viewpoints in America and the world.
Let's move to some questions from you because we don't have a whole lot of time left. Here's a member of the audience who asks, when a journalist sees bad people in power doing bad things for the country, Should that journalist offer a viewpoint versus just reporting facts as they are?
I write an opinion column, so I have the right to take them out.
Any other thoughts on that question?
One of the ethical issues that's out there now that we've probably all read about and you have read about is this Linda Greenhouse controversy at the New York Times. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning Supreme Court correspondent, and she had recently made a speech where she gave her opinion about certain issues like abortion, and now she's being chastised by her employer. I mean, again, I think we're in a new era. This idea that we all grew up with, that there is such a thing as objectivity, is indeed a false god. It's a myth. I mean, psychologists, philosophers, everybody realizes that when we try to weigh things with each other to create a sense of objectivity, we're doing it in a subjective way that often reflects our prejudices or beliefs in one way or another. There's a large, large difference between opinion, which is somebody on the street corner saying Bush is an asshole, with somebody who is writing with experience and a point of view, who has done reporting, who understands the subject, and at the end of the piece says, look, you know, the preponderance of the evidence, in my opinion, is this way rather than that way. That's a statement of authority. That's not an opinion. And I think as journalism evolves, we're going to move much more toward a situation like that, which is transparency, as Jeff says, where you're marshaling the evidence and making the case and someone can agree with me or not, as opposed to this idea of, on the one hand, on the other, the sense of objectivity that we all grew up with.
All right, here's a question. What is a remedy for the notion that the press is less than ethical? I mean, that supposes that you buy into that assumption.
I'd have to know the basis of the assumption. I mean, if you're talking about individuals, that's one thing. If you're talking about institutions, that's another. From a journalist who works in the field on various stories all the time, what I try to do is to be honest, to listen, to report what I hear, to get differing opinions about what it is I'm being told, to fact check, and to try to transmit to the viewers the essence, the truth, as I find it at that point in time of the story. We all, every day, I think, work to do the best job that we can. And on the other hand, we do have some people whose job it seems to be to accuse a lot of us of being unethical. Now, it's an accusation that most of the time I don't think has foundation.
And why, Randall, and the rest of you, why do you think that accusation now is being lofted so relentlessly?
Because there are more people to make the accusation. There are more sources. Yes. Yes.
All right, folks, please, let's... afterwards, please. Anyone
well,
else?
I was... I couldn't hear that.
You know, we can't hear you on the microphone, so I'm afraid this afterwards you can come up and raise these questions.
Well, listen, let me just expand on what I was saying. What I mean is that you now have talk radio, talk TV. There are some networks that do give opinion and not... They've already moved away from what we used to call objectivity, and they've done it with firmness. Fox is one of them. To some extent, some of the cable operations do the same thing. And you hear accusations about the press being liberal, the press being anti-government, the press being not...
Ethical.
Ethical, yeah. They make the charges, but what's the proof? So I say that you have to look at the stories that... What are you talking about when you make that kind of allegation? That's what I would want to know.
Well, I do think that the there is a widespread feeling that the press is unethical at this point, or that it has... I mean, just look at this panel. What's the subject of this panel? The sort of base assumption that we were all invited to talk about was that there was some kind of major ethical problem that journalists had to face. And I think that that itself is that itself is a problem. The image of journalists as unethical is something that the journalists have not fought back as a group, as an institution, as a community, as a and it's largely been it's largely been, I think, the work of this administration, who has been very, very effective in trying to whittle the press down to as powerless an entity as it could be. And one of the weapons it has are the ethical transgressions that journalists do make, no question about it.
A lot of bad things that have happened in the last 2 or 3 years that have been revealed.
But I don't think that
I think they were tarred with the same brush.
Well, that's right. But I think that those are specific and not that numerous.
No.
You know, I mean, you've been around a long time, and I'm.
But he keeps reminding me of that.
You know, I would. You know, I would strongly guess that this is no more ethically troubled a period for journalists than any other period in the last 50 or
so
years.
Maybe it's more revealed now.
I don't think so.
All right, let's another question here. One of you asks, at one time, TV news departments were the only not-for-profit departments within the broadcast networks. How did the change or demand by corporations for the new divisions to make a profit change news reporting?
Well, first of all, I think that's, with all due respect to the person who asked the question, that's not quite true. It was something called the Federal Communications Commission Community Ascertainment Public Interest Convenience and Necessity Requirement. Okay, what am I talking about? There was a time that in order for station owners to keep their licenses, they had to go out and ask community leaders and people around the area, what do you think the number one problems are? How should they be addressed? And in some way, the stations were then required to fold those answers into their broadcast. They were required to have a certain number of hours or minutes devoted to religious programming and children's programming. They were required to do public service. They were required to do a certain amount of news. Well, when the Telecommunications Act was revised in 1996, those requirements were changed. Some of them were totally eliminated. And so station owners no longer had to do certain things, but they did have to be responsible to their stockholders. They did have to show a profit. And so a lot of stations, a lot of companies stopped doing news, period. So it's not that the news department was supposed to be non-profit. It was a service that the government required as one of the trade-offs for giving license holders the privilege of broadcasting.
That belong to the American people.
Yeah, so it was never non-profit in that sense. But what our network, for example, always did was to fund it from its profit-making arms, and up to a point not expect the company, the news divisions, to make money. Well, that sort of changed a little bit. And now I am over my pay grade, and so I'll stop.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question. When people's tastes have gone down, reality TV shows, quick media hits, etc., how can you trust the audience and have such faith in them? And I guess the question is, how can you base programming on such base desires?
I'll defend Jeff. The people.
In fact, this is addressed at you, Jeff.
Oh, all right. HBO. One answer I have is HBO. The golden age of television was not the age of vaudeville and Milton Berle. The golden age of television started in the mid-'80s when we had choice. Is there crap on network TV? Yes, always has been. Are there crap at bookstores? Yes, always has been. The economics of network TV are changing as the mass audience dies, as we are no longer a mass. And so what it enables, however, is wonderful new things like HBO. I just spent the last week on the PATH train to New Jersey watching Weeds from Showtime on my iPod and having a great time. It's a wonderful show, by the way. $1.99 episode, buy it. That show could not be possible. Sopranos could not be possible in an age of one-size-fits-all tapioca media. So the fact that the big networks are trying to save money by having quote-unquote reality TV is just part of the economics, and I think that's okay. But it also means that what we have to look to now is not that we are all going to watch the same thing and it's all good. That died when we all rose up one morning and asked, who shot JR? We don't care anymore. And so what we have now is great new opportunities. And so I watch all kinds of video podcasts now that are wonderful, some of them crappy, from all around the world. I have new choices now that didn't exist before. And I don't think we can tar the people with the brush of saying that because, in fact, a small number of Americans watch, pick your reality show, that means we're all tasteless loons. We're not.
Helen, here's a question for you. What's wrong with the White House press corps?
They rolled over and played dead in the run-up to the war. It was so clear from the moment President Bush stepped into the White House he was going to war. All of a sudden, after 10 years, 12 years, Saddam Hussein was on the radar screen. What had he done? What had except that he was the enfant terrible, the monster, and so forth. But what had the Iraqis done? Nothing. But day after day, and especially after 9/11, Ari Fleischer was at the podium. 9/11, Saddam Hussein. 9/11, Saddam Hussein. There was not a day that he didn't pass it up. After it was all over and we were in the Pentagon was Ahmed Shalabi, who was the chief defector, was on the payroll to the tune of $340,000 a month and so forth, listening to all this. The buildup, the American people, and they were really deceived, and I think the press just absolutely lost its soul on that score. Mm-hmm. Two very brief stories. After Ari Fleischer left the White House, wrote his memoirs, he said, yes, it's true, and he says in the memoirs, well onto it, yes, it's true. I said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and you know what? There weren't any, but we won the election. Shalabi, almost a week or so after President Bush declared mission accomplished, gave an interview to a British reporter, I think for the Observer, London, or went to London or Paris, and he said to him, yeah, it's true. I said that there were ties to Al-Qaeda and there were weapons and so forth. And you know what? There weren't any. But we got the American troops here.
Here's a question for Rick. Has the press lost its nerve under all the attacks?
Has it lost its nerve? Because of the attacks against it?
I assume that's what the import of the question is.
I've spent many years not being a journalist, and it's always instructive, and I spent a few years in politics, and I remember working for a candidate who will remain nameless, because none of you will believe that he was doing focus groups in Iowa, which I was doing, and I remember sitting and listening to people, and one of the questions had to do with what professions do they value in America, and journalists were at the very bottom of the totem pole, and I remember our pollster turned to me and he said, you don't realize this, but you're in a very low status profession. We live in New York in this funny bubble, and you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know when I say that the Upper West Side is not exactly representative of the rest of America. But journalists are not well thought of as a species. There have been different times when we've been better thought of than others, and I think at this point in time, it's not one of them. I think people from both sides think that, you know, A, we didn't stand up to the administration, and there are plenty of people feel that journalists ought to reflect the sentiments of the republic as a whole, and I don't know that we acquitted ourselves very well, but that to me is the is the beauty of what we do, is that every day you have another chance to redeem yourself, and every day readers and viewers and watchers have a chance to evaluate that. I mean, that is what I think the framers were trying to protect, and we do struggle with that and grapple with that every day.
Well, my feeling is you have one privilege, and that is the press has the privilege of asking the President of the United States the question. Nobody else in the country does. It's the one forum, the one institution. And if you don't ask the President, then he's not asked, because the Congress is not going to subpoena him unless it's so dire. So we really, really are the last line of defense we are the transmission belt for the American people. If we don't ask the questions, they're not asked.
Here is a good question, which I think what we'll do is just go right down the line and let you all answer briefly. And they haven't answered them all, and they wouldn't answer them all if they were here for a light year. But let's try this one. What are the major problems confronting the press today? Helen, start with you.
Major problems.
The major problems confronting the press today.
Well, I think that certainly we have to reassert. We have to tell the American people our role. They will never know. The American people will never know how tough it is to get the answers, to get to the truth, to get the government to break down the incredible wall of secrecy. And I think there has to be more and more understanding. And I certainly think that we have to eliminate all those horrible faults that we have been exposed, fabrication and so forth, that are just unbelievable. But I think that the press has really let the country down by not being in there and working hard.
Mm-hmm. Randall?
I kind of like the member of the audience who said, let Helen answer all of the questions. I agree with that, and I would also say that it's the same challenge we always face when you get an assignment as an individual journalist, which is what I am. You go out and you try to find people who can tell you the truth. And I'm sort of old school. I still think that there are some universal truths, and that it doesn't do our viewers good if we know something isn't true, and we present it with the same kind of weight, the same kind of presentation as fiction, fantasy. So I'm still searching for that true story myself.
And indeed, as the phrase goes, speaking truth to power is our role, and rebutting government was the role that the framers had instructed us to do. But I think the biggest challenge facing the media today is reckoning with the relationship between the public and what we do, that we can no longer preach from on high and tell people what's important and what not what's important. We have to figure out what a collaborative enterprise is, and between readers and what we do. And I think that is, in fact, we can end up having one of the great high water marks of journalism if we actually incorporate citizen journalism, and journalists act like citizens and citizens act like journalists. I think that's an extraordinary future. We just have to figure out what it looks like.
I certainly feel that our journalists' lack of aggressiveness, its timidity, I think that there's definitely a chill that most sort of establishment journalists have been feeling the last few years. That's certainly one of the biggest problems that journalism has. I think that there's a massive complication of the sort that Rick is describing that has to do with the business of journalism and how it can afford to make money doing what it's doing. But I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, what I had said before, which is that the climate that it operates in, and I don't know the answer to this, but the climate that it operates in is much less interested in it succeeding. I do worry terribly that the American people as a whole do not value freedom of the press the way that it used to. And I think that we can't do our jobs unless they do. And if we don't do a better job trying to educate people about what will happen if we fail to be able to do our job in this way, then I think that, you know, we'll have some serious problems as a country.
Jeff?
I think there's a cultural crisis in the estate, and the people just don't quite know where to turn right now. My biggest lesson after having become a blogger in September 2001, something I thought I would do, by the way, for a few weeks, that then took over all available life, but that it's about a change of control. And my haughty PowerPoint line is that my first law of media and life is that if you give the people control, we will use it, and if you don't, you will lose us. And I don't think the business is ready to hand over control. So that's the first cultural challenge. The second is indeed a business challenge. I think we have a crisis of imagination. We're too concerned with trying to preserve something in the past and absolutely terrified of letting it go. And the future will not look like the past. It absolutely will not. The business will not look the same. It will be different in many, many ways, but it can grow in many ways if we have the imagination to get there. And so I think it's true of both the journalistic side and the business side, which is going to support journalism, that we have to reinvent ourselves and start to get busy about doing that.
Well, thank you all, and join me in thanking our panelists.
This recording was made available by the New York Sound Posse, online at nysoundposse.com.